I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. I'm here to have conversations. Real, honest, authentic conversations. The kind we aren't supposed to have anymore. I interview anyone I find interesting, from left to right to everywhere in between. I work independently in order to have the freedom to say what I believe and speak to whoever I want. Staying independent has allowed me to speak freely and to tell the truth, no matter how unpopular, for many years now, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. We have seen over the last few years how deeply compromised big media is and how willing mainstream journalists are to twist facts and hide the truth to sell a narrative. I opted out of mainstream media and a traditional career path for a reason. I want to come to my own conclusions and not be compromised by financial, political, ideological, or corporate limitations. I refuse to trade my integrity or my free speech for a paycheck. But that means I need your help. I rely on donors and patrons, so individuals, to support my work so that I can continue to do what I do. If you appreciate the kinds of conversations we're having at The Same Drugs and want to support my work, a great way to do that is by becoming a subscriber on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Megan Murphy or on Substack at meganmurphy.ca, where subscribers can be sure not to miss a single episode, can access subscriber-only video content, and engage with the comment section, subscriber-only chats and AMAs, and keep up with my writing as well. I am doing monthly AMAs now where paying subscribers can submit questions to me about anything, and I'll respond via subscriber-only podcasts. So please do go ahead and subscribe and ask me whatever you want, and I'll do my best to answer. You can, of course, also follow and support this podcast directly on Spotify by clicking the follow button, and you can support this podcast directly there by clicking the support button on the Same Drugs podcast page. Finally, don't drink the Kool-Aid. You may have seen me in a very stylish shirt with a very timeless message online, and you can get your very own by going to www.meganmurphy.ca and clicking on the shop tab. There is lots of other cool stuff over there, stickers, hats, and some of my favorite supplements and health products I use and sometimes mention on YouTube, so do check it out. Thank you so much for supporting Conversations Outside the Algorithm. Today on the show, I'm speaking with John Carpe, founder and president of the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. John, hi. Thank you so much for joining me. It's so great to see you again. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. We have much more to discuss. We seem to always have a lot to discuss with regard to Justin Trudeau's ongoing attempts at dictatorship.
You're so subtle.
I can't be subtle anymore. It just keeps coming and coming and coming, and I'm at the end of my rope. But I shouldn't say I'm at the end of my rope, because the end of my rope is probably yet to come. We'll see. The most recent bill that we're dealing with now is called Bill C-63. This comes after a bill that he passed last year that was another attempt to regulate the internet, let's say, which I hope that I'm explaining this properly, but as I understand it, tasked the CRTC with regulating platforms like YouTube, for example. So not just, you know, radio, television stuff, but what's happening online under the guise of promoting CanCon, but also I feel this has happened to me in any case where I've just been removed from the algorithm for criticizing the Liberal Party too much. That kind of thing is bad enough, but now this bill C-63 is, if passed, threatens to either fine or jail people who post things that other Canadians really don't like on the internet.
Well, that's accurate, unfortunately. There's about a half dozen elements to it. Maybe I'll just mention each one and then, you know, you can delve into them. One of them is expanding the powers of the Canadian Human Rights Commission so that they can prosecute non-criminal speech that they deem to be hateful. And there's all kinds of problems with that. I mean, a $50,000 fine, $20,000 paid to somebody who feels victimized. Anyway, that's one big aspect of it, is to give these new powers to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, which it used to have under the former Section 13 that was abolished about 10 years ago, and now we're bringing it back. Anyway, that's one aspect. The other aspect is to give powers to the federal cabinet to create new regulations to censor the online speech of social media services. And there's going to be a digital safety commission to monitor and investigate and enforce and punish to enforce those regulations and punish people who don't abide by the regulations that are created by cabinet without any input from parliament, without debate in parliament. Cabinet gets these powers to make up all these rules. We won't even know what they are, what they might be, until after the bill is passed. A third component is to increase the maximum penalty for advocating for genocide, which is already a criminal code offense. Currently, the maximum penalty is 5 years. This would elevate that to life imprisonment if you said, you know, death to people group X. If you advocated for genocide, you could spend up to a lifetime in prison. Another component is preemptive punishment. This is probably the creepiest, most Orwellian. I'm going to look at the movie Minority Report. I've not seen the movie, but people say, oh, that sounds like Minority Report. So this movie where apparently the government has these clairvoyants or something, these psychics that they know ahead of time when you're going to commit a crime, and they'll lock you up in jail before you've done anything. Right. So there's actually a provision in the Online Harms Act that you can be hauled before a judge and potentially you can be placed under house arrest, ankle bracelet, all kinds of restrictions on your freedom, give up your legally acquired, legally owned firearms, be told that you cannot contact certain people, you cannot go to certain places, because somebody else fears that you might advocate for genocide or do hate speech. So based on something that you might say in future, you could have your rights violated today. So that's probably the creepiest, most Orwellian part of it. And the other point is just that you know, the salesmanship is so clever. It's all about protecting children from online harm. Who right. could possibly disagree with that? Yeah. And yet almost everything in the bill is already a criminal code offense. So that's kind of the summary of the various tentacles.
Right. Well, I guess I'm staying in Mexico. I want to know a bit more about the protecting kids aspect of the bill, because that has been how the bill has been marketed, let's say, by much of Canadian media and by the Liberal Party. Are there aspects to the bill that are about protecting kids online?
Short answer is yes. And it's adding on. Here would be the question to think about. Do we want additional laws on top of the pretty clear criminal code prohibitions, yes or no? And I guess there's pros and cons to that. But let me briefly go through what's already a criminal code offense. You could be charged and get a criminal record, potential jail time, whatever the maximum penalty is. So willful promotion of hatred against an identifiable group based on race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression. So the TERFs have to watch out. So that's already criminal code offense. Willful promotion of hatred can get you into trouble. Advocacy of violence, terrorism, and advocacy of any criminal code violation. If I counsel you to go shoplift or to kill somebody, whether small crime, major crime, that's a crime in and of itself to counsel criminal code offense. Uttering threats is criminal code offense. If I say that, you know, if you don't do such and such, I'm going to burn your house down, or I'm going to punch you in the face, I'm going to destroy your property. Uttering threats is already criminal code offense, which of course would cover a lot of bullying and intimidation. Posting revenge porn is already a criminal code offense. Posting online intimate image without the without that person's consent is already criminal code offense. So when they say we want to protect the children, it's like, well, okay, so why, can you please explain why these criminal code provisions are not working? Does that mean the police don't have enough resources, or does that mean that there aren't enough people to threaten the online platform? I mean, if you're an online platform right now, social media or any kind of internet, or child pornography is another example, it's already illegal. So if you are a social media service and you've got revenge porn or child pornography, you're already breaking the criminal code. If you get contacted by police that tell you to take it down, like, I imagine people would take it down instantly, immediately, if they were not aware of it. So my question would be, why do we need, and I'm the view, we don't need another layer of laws when this is covered. And if it's not working, okay, so why are these criminal code provisions not good enough, strong enough? Is it a resources problem that we need more police?
Right. Yeah. I wonder about the incentive as well. Because I mean, not only are all these things that you just listed already criminalized. I mean, there are already hate speech laws in Canada against, advocating genocide or advocating violence. Why the extra step? What's the incentive behind that, do you think?
Okay. I will speculate, because I don't pretend to know what is in the hearts and minds of Justice Minister Arif Virani or the Prime Minister. I think it's their way to try to chill speech that they don't like. What they say in their sound bites, in their speaking points, they are talking about fighting homophobia, transphobia, misogyny, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. Mm. And so right now, the criminal code provisions against hate speech are fairly narrow. And the Crown has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. So if they want to charge somebody here's a perfect example. Okay, if you're a trans exclusionary radical feminist, or if you're a TERF, if you say there's only two genders and people who are biologically male should not be allowed access into a women's change room or female sporting events, it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that you're going to face criminal charges for willful promotion of hatred against an identifiable group based on gender identity and gender expression. You're not going to face criminal charges. Okay. However, you might face a human rights complaint. And that one, even if it's ultimately dismissed at the end of the day, you're going to get a letter in the mail and there's been a complaint filed against you. And what is your response? And you're going to have this hanging over your head for years before you finally, if you choose to fight it, you know, your lawyer might say, hey, unless you're prepared to spend tens of thousands of dollars, you might as well just apologize and cut a $5,000 check and be done with it. So my guess is that because the criminal code provisions, the Crown needs to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt that you said something that is hateful, that you did it on purpose, that you intended to promote hatred. And then there's these defenses like truth. Under the criminal code, you can defend yourself against prosecution for hate speech with the defense of truth. Under human rights legislation, truth is not a defense. In the criminal code, you can face your accuser, question your accuser, cross-examine your accuser. Under human rights legislation, the complainant could be anonymous, and you don't even know who complained against you, and you can't necessarily cross-examine your accuser or even know who he is. So my theory about why they're pushing this is that the criminal code provisions against hate speech are fairly narrow. They cannot be readily used you're not going to have thousands or hundreds or even dozens. I mean, when somebody is charged with violating Section 319 of the Criminal Code, it's like it makes headline news because it's so rare. It doesn't happen very often. Whereas here under human rights, the commission and giving them powers to prosecute non-criminal hate speech, they have a much greater chilling effect with which in their minds, this is the way that they're going to stamp out Islamophobia, homophobia, transphobia, whatever. They're going to stamp out the speech that they dislike. That's my theory as to why they want to add an additional layer of law.
It does seem like the government is amping up to criminalize dissent. Not only is this bill in the works, but there were reports recently that CSIS had determined that what they called the anti-gender movement, so that refers to, you know, people like me who don't believe that people can change sex, as well as the parents who are fighting for parental rights and who want to know what their kids are being taught in school and don't want their kids being told at school, for example, that, you know, now you're not a boy, you're actually a girl, and we're going to call you Sarah without their knowledge. They're framing those people and people like me as terrorists. And it just, yeah, it feels like they're setting us up here for something.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I'm such a passionate advocate for free speech, is because it is about you and me and everybody listening to the podcast or watching the video, that we as adults say, you know what, I can make up my own mind about what is true or false. Mm-hmm. And I want to keep that power for myself and be responsible for it. And I might get deceived and sometimes, you know, come to the wrong conclusion and I might get misled. But like, this is me as an adult. I get to decide what is true, false, what is right or wrong, what is good or evil, what is harmful, what is not harmful. I'm not going to abdicate that and give it over to some government agency, government power, for the government to decide what is true or false. Now, the thing that's crazy about the current scenario, the people that are supporting the Online Harms Act seem to think that their side will be in power forever. But no, you have swings. You look at the United States, right? Everybody knew the fact that Donald Trump was going to lose the election in 2016. You know, that was beyond debate. We knew he was going to lose, and yet he won the election, and you get very different politics. And so 20 years from now, who knows what kind of a government there will be in Canada. But if there's like a massive religious revival, or if there's, different kinds of immigration or whatever, you could have a very different government 20 years from now. And they're going to use these same tools. And they're going to say, well, I don't like your speech because your speech, like, you're promoting LGBTQ stuff, and we don't agree with that. And you're promoting radical feminism, and you're promoting this, and you're promoting that. You're promoting transgenderism. And now we're going to go after you for your speech. And that's what happens if you abdicate those powers. It's going to come back and bite you in the butt.
For sure. And yeah, it was sort of interesting to see some of the progressives realize that when they felt their speech was being cracked down on in terms of Free Palestine rallies and things like that. Suddenly it seemed like maybe the shoe was on the other foot, and they were complaining about the attacks on their free speech when they were the very same people who were cheering on attacks on other people's free speech. I am curious to know what the point of the Human Rights Tribunal is. Why does this entity exist?
The human rights legislation was created and passed into law in the 1960s. And the original idea was that we should reject racism and sexism and ageism, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And so the idea was, we don't want to live in a country where there's a newspaper ad for like a want ad, a jobs ad, but saying, you know, Jews need not apply, or women need not apply, blacks need not apply, et cetera, et cetera. And so most people were in favor of this. They thought, you know, this is like, yeah, this is good. Like, you should not, in hiring and firing and promotion, renting out apartments, retail stores providing services, we shouldn't discriminate on the basis of these grounds, including age, sex, skin color. Later on in the mid-90s, sexual orientation was added. And then in the maybe 10 years ago or less, gender identity, gender expression was added, which at the time nobody cared. Oh, okay, well, we're just adding one more ground, right? But now it's like, oh, okay, so yeah, it's proven to be quite problematic. I got a phone call just a few weeks ago from somebody who's running a business, and one of it's sort of a medium large business. It might have 50 or 100 people, and there's one of the guys there has declared that he is now a woman and he's going to have female name, female clothes, and so on, and wants to use the women's bathroom at this business. It's a private business. And the employer is like, no, like he can't use the women's bathroom. I'm going to lose female employees over this. They're going to quit and leave because women don't want a dude in their bathroom. But yet, from a legal standpoint, under the Human Rights Act of the province, where this guy runs his business, he would likely lose if he did not provide this guy access to the women's washroom. This person would file a human rights complaint and he would likely lose, and he would be ordered, you've got to provide access to this biological male to go into the women's bathroom. Sorry, I'm going on too long, but you asked about human rights legislation. So it started in the 60s. Personally, I think it went off the rails a bit or a lot when it added speech to it. Mm-hmm. And there's only BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and the federal government are the only four human rights regimes where your speech is caught by the legislation. The Ontario provincial legislation does not apply to speech, right? It only applies to hiring and firing and providing public services.
So, but you know, these human rights tribunals, I think, are sort of specific to Canada because I don't believe they have such a thing in the US. Is that right?
No, they might call them civil rights, but in the US, there are federal and provincial laws that if you are, you know, you're running a business and let's say you're a racist against, you know, Black people or Jews, Hispanics, whatever, and if you are caught or found out to be deliberately discriminating against a group of people based on their race or their sex, then yeah, the United States has similar laws. That's why you get like the Baker's case, for example, right? Where there's somebody goes into the bakery and says, you know, I want you to do a special wedding cake. And then the store owner said, I gladly, cheerfully serve gay people and they can buy cakes, but then like the wedding cake itself, it's a specific work of art and I don't want to participate in that. That's an example where, and there's a human rights complaint filed against that person and eventually made its way to the US Supreme Court.
Right. I mean, so one of the interesting aspects out of the many interesting aspects of this bill is that individuals can report other Canadians anonymously. You mentioned this earlier. Why is that? You know, why should it be acceptable for a person who's reporting someone else for a crime, dragging them through this human rights tribunal process, potentially ending them up in jail all the while they stay anonymous? I mean, how can there be any validity to such a charge?
It's a good question. The answer that the federal government puts forward is that we need to allow anonymous complaints in order to protect the complainant from threats or violence or retaliatory discrimination. And my answer to that is uttering threats is a criminal code offense. People are either they're not going to do it, or if they are going to do it, you can get in serious trouble. It's criminal to utter threats. Retaliatory discrimination is also prohibited. So, for example, if you filed a human rights complaint against your boss for discriminating against women, right, that women are not being fairly treated in the workplace for what promotion or salary, whatever. Okay. If he retaliates, then you can file an additional complaint against that. So you can't retaliate. So basically it's already covered because we have thousands, presumably thousands of criminal trials in Canada every day, right? If you think about all the courtrooms all across Canada, at least hundreds, possibly thousands of trials. And we have witnesses there and it's all public. And so if you threaten a witness and say, you know, if you, you better not show up, testify at trial, otherwise I'm going to hurt you or damage your property or whatever, that's criminal. So we don't need to have anonymous complaints in order to protect the complainant because the complainant is already protected by other laws. But that's their rationale. That's why they say, oh, we gotta allow for anonymous complaints in order to protect the complainant from getting, you know, violence perpetrated against them.
It's crazy because there's so much incentive for these people to submit complaints now. I mean, not only could they get, they could make $20,000 and no skin off their nose at all.
Well, that's another interesting point is that in ordinary court proceedings in Canada and in other countries as well, not so much in the US, but in Canada, if you sue somebody and lose, you are on the hook for a portion of their legal bills. So depending on the nature of the trial, the nature of the claim, how long it went on, I've seen cost awards of $100,000, $150,000 awarded against people that lost their, you know, whether they're as plaintiff or as defendant, the loser pays. But here you can file a complaint and you can force somebody else to incur tens of thousands of dollars in legal bills. And then at the end of the day, if your complaint is dismissed, you just walk away.
Crazy. So what is the current punishment for hate speech?
I would have to look up the maximum penalty. For section 319 of the criminal code, the willful promotion of hatred, I don't know off the top of my head. On the advocacy for genocide, which is a similar crime, right? That's if you said that an entire group of people should be killed because of their race, gender, sexual orientation, whatever. Maximum penalty currently is 5 years. Mm-hmm. The Online Harms Act would change the criminal code and that could become life imprisonment.
Right.
Which is interesting because that's the same penalty, maximum penalty for manslaughter. And of interest, sexually assaulting a minor under the age of 16, the maximum penalty is 14 years in jail. So they're saying raping a child, maximum penalty, 14 years. Advocating for genocide, maximum penalty, life in prison, which is 25 years.
Crazy.
So quite a gap there.
Do you think that we should be regulating speech online? Is there anything that you would say should be regulated or should be punished in as far as speech online goes?
Well, the online speech is already covered by the criminal code. So whether I am speaking orally, I think private conversations are exempt. Okay. So I could send a pretty vicious email to a friend. And as long as it's between us, then, you know, but if it's public, if I post it on a website or if I say it in a speech while speaking in public, or if it's, whether it's on the internet or offline, whether it's written, whether it's oral, it's already criminal. And so the online willful promotion of hatred is already criminal. Same with threatening, intimidating children or adults online is already criminal. But the Online Harms Act, really, it gives the federal government way more control because now the federal cabinet, if this passes in its current form, the federal cabinet can create all kinds of rules in secret, without input from parliament, without a vote from parliament. The federal government can create all kinds of rules to govern the social media services. And then the providers are going to do the government's censorship work because the provider does not want to get in trouble with the Digital Safety Commission. And so the provider is going to memorize all these regulations and enforce them. And so what's going to happen is social media, including, I guess, you know, Facebook and Twitter, now called X, but other platforms, smaller platforms, they're going to be the operators are themselves going to do the government's dirty work and start to remove posts that might run afoul of federal regulations. That's the problem.
Yeah. And so I want to talk a little bit more about this pre-crime aspect of the bill. You know, you mentioned earlier that what's, you know, one of the strange parts about this bill is that people can be charged if it's determined that they might commit hate speech in the future. How does that work?
So the complainant would be the person that fears that, let's call him Ralph Smith. Okay, apologies to any Ralph Smiths that are listening. But the complainant, if the complainant fears that Ralph Smith is going to advocate for genocide or promote anti-Semitism willfully promote hatred. So if the complainant fears that this guy is going to commit a speech crime, the complainant can go to court and file that complaint with the court. And then the person gets to also come before a judge, which is like, yeah, you get an opportunity to respond, which is great, but it's a pain in, it's a, like you're getting hauled before the court. If the judge is persuaded that the complainant has reasonable grounds to fear, so the fear is justified, reasonable grounds that Ralph Smith is going to advocate for genocide. I don't know what those reasonable grounds would be. You know, maybe it's because he's done it before, or maybe because he said that he would do it. I don't know, whatever. If the judge believes that there are reasonable grounds, the judge can then say, okay, Ralph Smith, you know, here's conditions. You're under a curfew. You have to stay at home. You're under house arrest. You can't take alcohol and drugs. And we're going to require periodic bodily fluid samples to confirm that you're not taking alcohol and drugs. You're going to have to surrender your legally owned and legally acquired firearms, et cetera. And then if Ralph Smith says, well, that's outrageous, I'm not going to comply with those conditions, he could then be locked up in jail. Now, at the end of the day, I don't think too many people are going to get these conditions ordered against them. However, the process is the punishment. Mm. So what this would open up the door towards is you get people go off to court and file a complaint with the court and say, I'm scared that Ralph Smith is going to advocate for genocide. And then there's that whole process there, right? Like being ordered to attend court is, you know, technically it's not a punishment, but in reality, it is a kind of a punishment, you know?
Well, and you need to hire a lawyer, presumably.
Whenever you've got a legal problem, you're better off to retain a lawyer. And
like, it's costly, it's stressful, it's time consuming.
Yeah.
I have an example actually of this that might be applicable, because last year, I'm not sure if you guys heard about this or not, but we had booked the Cowichan Community Center over on Vancouver Island. Oh, yes, I heard Island. About
it. Yep. Yeah. We have a mutual event. Friend. Yeah.
Oh, do we? Okay. That doesn't surprise me. And so we'd booked it for October 4th, and it was all good. We'd submitted the title of the event and the poster, who was going to be speaking, so on and so forth. And then, you know, a couple days just before the event was to take place, the Cowichan Community Center canceled us, and they referenced BC's human rights code and essentially accused us of, you know, she was saying essentially that it was likely that we were going to engage in hate speech, so they had to cancel us. I'm just reading her letter right now again, but so she says, as a public facility, we're required to follow policy under the BC Human Rights Code. Given the likelihood that the purpose of this event is to promote or would have the effect of promoting discrimination, contempt, or hatred for any group or person on the basis of sex, gender identity, gender expression, sexual orientation, or any other similar factor, it's determined that this rental must be canceled. And she goes on to say, BC's Human Rights Code prohibits speech that discriminates or intends to discriminate against a person or group of people because of characteristics, including race, place of origin, religion, disability, sex, and gender identity. The same speech might be both hate speech and discriminatory speech, but that's not always the case. So, you know, I feel as though I was accused essentially of just this, what we're talking about, pre-crime. There was no evidence to suggest that I would engage in hate speech. We'd just done another event prior on the island in Nanaimo. The whole thing was videoed. You know, she could watch any talk that I've done and see that I'm not guilty of hate speech. I mean, I suppose on some level that's up for interpretation. But I mean, like to me, I was like, you know, this will be perfect for her. She'll have the perfect defense to refuse any booking again, to never book us, and so will every other public facility in Canada.
Well, this is the problem with the subjectivity of what is hate. I think hate is real. However, people subjectively have different takes on what is hateful, what is not hateful. There's a slogan you've probably heard chanted at pro-Palestinian rallies that, quote, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, end of quote. And some people say that's hateful. It's a call for genocide. And other people vociferously would argue, no, it's not hateful. It's an assertion. It's a political belief. And it's, you know, strong language, but there's nothing hateful about it. It's most certainly is not a call to genocide. And this gets to be so subjective. Like, you've got Germany, Estonia, and Czech Republic are three places I'm aware of that say that that particular phrase is criminal speech, and they will charge you criminally if you say that in public. And then other places, the Dutch Supreme Court ruled that it was not, you know, criminal speech or hate speech. So that's one problem. Even the Supreme Court of Canada couldn't define hate after using more than 4,000 words in a decision about 10 years ago. It was the Saskatchewan Human Rights Tribunal versus Bill Watcott. Bill Watcott is an outspoken social conservative. He refers to gay people as sodomites, and he says that gay sex is bad for your soul, and you're going to go to hell, and it's bad for your body, and it's going to lead to all kinds of diseases. And that's basically, and he says it very undiplomatic. He says it in a polemical, undiplomatic fashion, where even people that are sympathetic to his views, they don't want to have anything to, it's like, yeah, no, you're on your own. Like, I, you know, even people who have similar views, they would articulate it differently. Anyway,
right.
So his case, he was handing out flyers in Saskatchewan. This is going back now, you know, close to, 15 years ago. And, the Supreme Court devoted 4,000 words to try and, you know, this crazy hair splitting. And they said, well, hate speech is if you promote detestation or vilification, but if you're promoting disdain and dislike, it's not hate speech. And if you mock and ridicule somebody and hurt their feelings, that's not hate speech. And promoting disdain and dislike is not hate speech. However, promoting vilification and detestation, that's hate speech. You got to watch out. So after 4,000 words, they couldn't get it right. Now, you couple the vagueness of, and the human rights codes are broader. Like the criminal code says the willful promotion of hatred. But the human rights codes say if you promote hatred and vilification, like it's much broader. So this is the problem. When the human rights codes include speech, you could have the local secretary of the Cowichan Community Center or the executive director, whoever the person is, could look at your speeches and they could personally feel that because you say that transgender women, I don't know if I'm getting the words right, but you say that biological males should not be allowed into a women's change room, that's hateful against transgender people. So the problem is not so much the lady working at the Cowichan Community Center. In my opinion, the real problem is a human rights code that includes the speech as opposed to just services.
Yeah, so that's true. Is that accurate? The BC Human Rights Code prohibits speech that discriminates or intends to discriminate?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's accurate. Now, of course, so that's one problem with human rights legislation is if it includes speech. The other problem is depending on what are the prohibited grounds of discrimination. In Calgary, where I live, there's a sports facility not far from where I live. It's called the Southland Leisure Center, and it has a gym and a pool and a rink and a whole bunch of stuff. And if there was a man who woke up one morning and decided that he was actually a woman, he could go into a girl's change room and I don't want my daughter, you know, or my wife or my mother to be exposed to male nudity, full stop. But here you've got a problem because the Alberta Human Rights Code says it prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender identity. And so you've got the Southland Leisure Center would give a thumbs up to a man going into a woman's change room. So this is a problem. If you add gender expression, gender identity and gender expression, if you add them to the Human Rights Code, you're going to get situations like that.
I feel like after all that we observed that happened during COVID, specifically the response to the truckers convoy, and I don't know if you've been following the case of the Coots 4, which seems to be persecution of these guys who were at the Coots border protest. And, you know, of course, Justin Trudeau's invoking of the Emergencies Act was ruled unconstitutional, which we knew it was unconstitutional, and there was not justification for invoking the Emergencies Act. I mean, you know, and then there's this, I'm trying to remember the name of the CRTC bill that's cracking down on what
C18 or C11, I think.
Okay. Yeah. You know, essentially controlling what Canadians will see online, what's accessible online. And now this, which, you know, not only is there a risk of fines and jail, but I think it really will quell speech because people won't know even what it is they're allowed to say or not say and what might get them thrown into this human rights tribunal process.
When I think the trans issue highlights that so clearly, how subjective it is to how somebody can view, one person can see something as hateful, the other person can see it as not hateful. And, you know, the opinion there's only two genders and somebody is biologically male, you know, should not have access to female sporting events, female prisons, female change rooms, etc. There are people who listen to that and they sincerely feel and believe that that's hateful speech. And the person speaking that speech said, no, that's just my opinion about what I think is just, you know, public policy. The same stuff comes up with, you know, pastors or an Orthodox Jewish rabbi or a Muslim imam at a mosque saying that, you know, for two guys to have sex with each other, that is detestable to God and it's a sin. And some people go, oh, well, that's hate speech. And they're going to, no, that's just what my religion teaches about sexuality. And it's so subjective that, it's unfortunate. It has that chilling effect because people self-censor. Now you and I are maybe we're not like the rest of the population. You and I and a, you know, number of other people are not likely to self-censor, but a lot of Canadians they're gonna zip it and shut up just to avoid facing a Canadian Human Rights Commission prosecution.
Yeah. And I think that's already sort of the culture in Canada in a lot of ways. You know, there's a lot of people who don't, you know, Canadians are sort of known for not wanting to rock the boat, being passive, being polite, so on and so forth. And it does seem like this kind of bill would make that worse. I do believe that that's worse. I think people should have free speech and that we should be debating all sorts of things in public, regardless of how controversial they are. Or whether or not, you know, they might hurt people's feelings. Do you think that I'm being hyperbolic when I say that Canada is moving in an authoritarian direction? You know, I fear for democracy in Canada.
No, this is pure authoritarianism. And you see it as well in some of the court rulings about COVID have been outrageous because they have abandoned the constitutional standard whereby the government is actually required to demonstrably justify with persuasive evidence any law, health order, any policy, any regulation. The governments have to, under the Constitution of Canada, demonstrably justify that it's okay to violate, you know, whichever it might be, your freedom of religion or conscience or expression or association or peaceful assembly, your right to bodily autonomy, which includes a right to accept or reject any medical treatment of any kind. Mm-hmm. And so there is a growing and very dangerous authoritarianism that even in the courts are saying, well, if the government shows some scientific support, you know, that's good enough. We're just going to rule in favor of the government. Government can trample on fundamental charter freedoms by showing some scientific support. And they have lowered the bar where it was before is that yes, a government could violate your, let's say, your freedom of speech with a, you know, criminal code prohibition on hate speech. However, they have to demonstrably justify that that's going to do more good than harm. And they've chosen the smallest amount of violation possible. So it's narrowly tailored to violate your free speech as little as possible, et cetera, et cetera. And so we see that the CRTC now having new powers to regulate online platforms and now this Online Harms Act and bringing back Canadian Human Rights Commission prosecutions. It's all very authoritarian and it's modern fascism. It's a mm-hmm. resurgence of superficially it's different, but there's that core there of trampling on individual rights and freedoms in the name of some higher good.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. This is also how I see things. Do you think that it's likely that this bill will pass?
I believe that if enough Canadians email and phone their member of parliament, at least some of the worst aspects might be withdrawn. For example, they might withdraw the preemptive punishment provision, mm-hmm. or they might say that complaints to the Canadian Human Rights Commission cannot be anonymous. They might water it down a little bit. I would imagine that some Liberal MPs right now are pretty nervous. I've not looked at the latest polling numbers, but I'm supposedly the Liberals are way down in the polls, and some of these Liberal MPs might be worried about losing their own seats. And so if there's enough Liberal MPs that get back to Trudeau and say, hey, my constituents don't want this, you could see it getting watered down. Then again, I think the people supporting it are pretty passionate about this, and they've been working on this for 2 years. So there will be a strong impetus, certainly for the Liberals, NDP, possibly the Bloc, to push it through.
And what do you think would happen if, for example, someone filed a complaint against me in Canada, accusing me of hate speech for saying, you know, men aren't women, but I was in Mexico?
My guess is that you are required to obey Canadian laws, regardless of where you live or where you happen to be. I'm not sure where they would mail the letter to, but like somehow, if somebody filed a complaint against you, they would get the complaint to you. And if you did not respond and did not defend yourself, ultimately there could be an order against you and you could be fined the up to $50,000 you have to pay to the government, up to $20,000 that you have to pay to the complainant. And then once that's filed, well, then it's an enforcement question. And if you have a bank account in Canada or property right. in Canada, they can ultimately enforce it against you. So living abroad, it's kind of a partial shield, but not fully.
Right. I mean, I knowing myself, I would be likely to fight it, but just curious to know what my options are.
Fighting it is good. That's how that, you know, because Ezra Levant and Mark Stein fought back because they faced complaints against Islamophobic speech, and they fought back very hard. And that brought enough attention to the issue that they repealed Section 13 from the Canadian Human Rights mm-hmm. Act. And for the past decade, there have not been these speech complaints. But, you know, if this bill passes in its current form, that's going to be brought back.
Oh, geez. Yeah. I mean, I am all in support of fighting. That's for sure. I hope this bill doesn't pass and that no one needs to fight on that basis. But if they do, if we do, it's a worthwhile fight to have. Thank you so much for your time. I wanted to also ask you, I think that the Justice Center has a petition going against this bill that people can sign.
Yeah, our website, please sign the petition. As of a few days ago, we already had 26,000 signatures. I'm going to be in Ottawa in April, and I'm going to print them out and drop off boxes and boxes and boxes at the Prime Minister's office. That's my goal. Our website, for those listening without the visual, it's www.jccf, that's Justice Center Constitutional Freedoms, JCCF, F as in freedom, .ca. And please sign the petition. And if you want to support our work to defend the free society, you know, donations are welcome as well.
Great. Thank you so much. I'll link to all that in the show notes. And I also encourage people to sign the petition and support the work that you all do, which is so important, especially these days in Canada. So thank you. Thank you for your work. And thanks again for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on your show. Have a great rest of the day.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. Thank you for tuning in. I produce and host this podcast all by myself and rely entirely on donors and subscribers to sustain my work. This is all me and you, the listener. If you want to keep episodes free as well as free thinking, please consider signing up on Patreon at patreon.com/Megan Murphy, subscribing on Substack at www.meganmurphy.ca, or donating directly to support this podcast via PayPal at paypal.me/thesamedrugs. If you do decide to become a paying subscriber on Substack or Patreon, there are all sorts of perks. You get subscriber-only access to video content. I do AMAs, and you can, of course, engage in the comment section and send me DMs to your heart's content that I do reply to. Going over to Spotify and clicking the follow button is another way to support the podcast, but paying subscribers really ensure that my work is sustainable. Either way, every little bit counts, and I'm grateful to every subscriber, listener, reader, and follower. Thank you so much for supporting Conversations Outside the Algorithm.